KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
I am deeply disappointed that we're here one day into the new administration, and also not at all surprised.
A judge has temporarily blocked President Trump's executive order that aims to end birthright citizenship. We hear from California's Attorney General.
For Thursday, January 23rd, it's All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. As the ceasefire between Israel and Hamas holds, we hear from Jewish people here in the U.S.
They describe their hopes and fears.
That's the biggest fear, I guess, that this war is not really ending, that we are not breaking this hate cycle, we're just doing a ceasefire.
And last week, the film Sing Sing was re-released across the country,
including for screenings at more than 1,000 correctional facilities.
You cut off the art, you cut off the soul, you cut off people understanding how to be human with each other.
Plus, a look at the Oscar nominations.
After the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Pete Hegseth's nomination to lead the Department of Defense cleared a procedural vote today. NPR's Deidre Walsh reports there's some Republican opposition, but it's not expected to derail him.
Alaska Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski announced she could not support Hegseth, citing his lack of experience and reports about excessive drinking and other inappropriate behavior that raised questions about his character. A second GOP Senator, Susan Collins of Maine, also plans to vote no. She raised doubt about him leading the large department and his previous comments about women serving in group combat roles. Hegseth backtracked on those, but Collins says she's not convinced his position has changed. Hegseth is not expected to get any support from Democrats, but he can afford to lose as many as 3 GOP votes. The final Senate vote is expected sometime on Friday, and Hegseth appears likely to be confirmed as Secretary of Defense, mostly along party lines. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News, the Capitol.
President Trump's nominee to lead Veterans Affairs easily passed Senate committee today. Also, NPR's Quo Lawrence reports the vast majority of VA staff were exempted from federal hiring freeze.
Doug Collins, an Air Force Reserve colonel and former Georgia congressman, was endorsed by the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee 18-1, almost guaranteeing he'll be the next Secretary of Veterans Affairs. During his confirmation hearing this week, he was pressed on whether President Trump's federal hiring freeze would apply to VA. He said he needed to study it. In the meantime, doctors and nurses nationwide who thought they had VA job offers got the news their offers were rescinded. After 2 days of mixed messages, the administration has now exempted the majority of healthcare positions at VA from the hiring freeze. Senate Democrats have urged Trump to protect all VA staff positions from the freeze. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
President Trump is calling on Saudi Arabia to lower oil prices, which he says could help bring an end to Russia's war in Ukraine. His remarks were from the White House and delivered by video to the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. More from NPR's Deepa Shivram.
After listing what he sees as accomplishments in his first week of office, Trump addressed the Economic Forum in Switzerland with a focus on tariffs, saying that if products aren't made in America, there will be tariffs added to them. He also said he would call on Saudi Arabia to bring down the cost of oil, and that doing so would, quote, immediately end the Russia-Ukraine war. Russia, which exports a lot of oil, has been relying on the high cost of it to sustain the war.
Right now, the price is high enough that that war will continue. You got to bring down the oil price. You got to end that war.
Trump also said China's Xi Jinping could help pressure Russia's Putin to end the conflict. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News, the White House.
U.S. financial markets closed mostly higher, with the broad market notching another record high today in hopes of falling interest rates. The S&P 500 gained 32 points. You're listening to NPR. Members of the powerful Sackler family, who own OxyContin maker Purdue Pharma and the company itself, are agreeing to pay out $7.4 billion to settle lawsuits over the toll of the powerful opioid painkiller. The deal is an improvement over a previous proposal that was rejected last year by the U.S. Supreme Court. The high court shot down the earlier proposal, largely because it protected members of the wealthy family from civil lawsuits over the drug, even though they were not in bankruptcy. Latest deal comes on top of about $50 billion in opioid settlements announced in recent years. A new study shows adults who are diagnosed with ADHD live shorter lives than people without such a diagnosis. More from NPR's Maria Godoy.
The study looked at more than 30,000 adults diagnosed with ADHD in the UK. The researchers used national data on mortality rates to estimate their life expectancy. They found that men diagnosed with ADHD were dying 7 years younger on average compared to their counterparts without a diagnosis. Women with ADHD lived an average of 9 years less. Prior research has found that factors including smoking, sleep, exercise, nutrition, and risky driving are key factors behind the shorter lifespans in adults with ADHD. Researchers say these factors are linked to impulsivity, which can be treated. The findings are in line with other research that finds untreated ADHD raises the risk of serious health problems such as diabetes and heart disease. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
Crude oil futures prices moved lower today. Oil down 82 cents a barrel to settle at $74.62 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at gundfoundation.org. This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. President Trump is trying to end birthright citizenship with a new executive order, but it is already under attack in the courts. There are at least four lawsuits filed, including from the ACLU and two groups of states, arguing that the right of those born in the U.S. to be automatically granted citizenship in this country is enshrined in the Constitution and cannot be abolished unilaterally by a president. Meanwhile, the president considers the right, quote, ridiculous. California has signed on to the lawsuit, and State Attorney General Rob Bonta joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. Grateful to be here.
So this order sets a start date that as of February 19th of this year, babies born to parents here in the United States without legal status will not be American citizens. As we mentioned, a federal judge has temporarily blocked the order, but I'd like to ask you, if it should go forward, what will that mean to people in your state of California and around the country?
My hope and belief, first and foremost, is that it never goes forward. It's blatantly unconstitutional. A judge found that today, issuing a temporary restraining order in the state of Washington. On day one, President Trump, with this action, managed to trample over the U.S. Constitution, attack American citizens, attack children, and do something that's very un-American and contrary to the law and to the U.S. Constitution. Should it go forward, it could create great irreparable harm and injury to those born after it goes into place, 30 days from its issuance date. In California, we think there's about 25,000 almost children who would be born every year that would be entitled to birthright citizenship, who would then be, if this executive order went into place, deportable at any time, wouldn't have access to federal programs that provide food assistance or housing or health care, things like Medicaid or Children's Health Insurance Program, and many other services, programs, and privileges of citizenship.
If I could, I want to jump here on the citizenship argument, if I can. This is predicated on the 14th Amendment, which reads, and I'm going to quote in part here, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof, end quote. They are automatically citizens, but as you may have heard, some conservative legal scholars argue that this phrase, subject to the jurisdiction thereof, that it has been misinterpreted, that it actually does not apply to children born in this country to non-citizens. How do you respond to that?
They're wrong, and they're advancing a fringe theory that no court in the United States of America have ever adopted, and the U.S. Supreme Court has rejected twice. So they can posit the theory that they wish. It's a fringe theory, and it's a Hail Mary at best. The Citizenship Clause of the 14th Amendment has been interpreted to mean what it says it means. It's plain and unambiguous. If you're a person, and these are persons born in the United States, and you're an American citizen, and the subject of the jurisdiction thereof is meant to address foreign diplomats who are not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. They're subject to the jurisdiction of their foreign home nation, and also potentially for foreign military forces okay. occupying the United States of America. That is not what this executive order is about. So it goes far beyond the interpretations of the U.S. Supreme Court, the plain and unambiguous language of the 14th right. Amendment, and it's blatantly unconstitutional.
Right. I hear that. But that said, the courts look dramatically different than they did before President Trump's first term, all the way up to the Supreme Court. How confident are you that the precedent that we are discussing will stand?
We're very confident. And today's decision shows what a federal judge thinks about it. He used words like it was mind-boggling. It boggled his mind that the U.S. government could even take this position. He said it was blatantly unconstitutional, their position. He said in 4 decades of service, since Reagan, President Reagan, a Republican, appointed him, that he had never seen a case like this that was so long from the United States government. So we expect that similar reception from courts throughout the United States. Any court that is fair, that is objective, that looks at the facts and applies the law, I believe will find the same way. Of course, we know that the U.S. Supreme Court looks different, right. But they must follow precedent. They must follow the U.S. Constitution, and I believe they will here.
The Justice Department has also turned attention to so-called sanctuary cities, indicating that officials who get in the way of immigration enforcement should face criminal charges. How are you planning to navigate that situation, or are there steps you are taking to protect local officials in your state in those sanctuary cities?
Yeah, absolutely. Unfortunately, that memo yesterday from a political appointee in the Trump administration was a blatant scare tactic, an attempt to bully states and local governments and law enforcement entities. We are fully within our rights to take the positions that we have throughout the United States to say in a very unremarkable way that the federal government is responsible for immigration enforcement. That's their job. They can do their job. And of course, we will allow them to do their job, but they cannot force us to do their job for them. The U.S. Constitution's 10th Amendment, the anti-commandeering principle therein, makes that clear and has upheld the law that we have in the state of California, SB 54, that says we're going to use our law enforcement resources to fight crime, not to be involved in immigration enforcement.
Quick answer here, if we can, this order revoking birthright citizenship, it's just part of a host of actions from the Trump administration that are meant to reshape the immigration system. We have about 30 seconds. Any concern that putting so much energy into fighting this order will draw resources and attention away from other actions?
No, we do it all. We walk and chew gum at the same time. Anytime there's an unlawful action, an unconstitutional action, we will see Mr. Trump in court and we'll hold him accountable and we'll stop him from taking that action. This was a day one action that was clearly unconstitutional, so we stopped him.
All right.
Any other time there's similar actions, we'll stop him there too.
Rob Bonta, California's Attorney General, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Academy Award nominations are out today. Among them, the movie Sing Sing is nominated in 3 categories. Last week, it was re-released in theaters around the country. That's not unusual for an Oscar contender. What is unusual is that Sing Sing was also made available for screenings at more than 1,000 correctional facilities. The movie stars Colman Domingo alongside a cast of real-life formerly incarcerated actors, which is poetic because it's the story of a group of incarcerated actors who work together to stage an original musical. Brittany Luce, host of NPR's It's Been a Minute, spoke with Domingo about how the film imagines new futures for Black and brown men inside and outside of lockdown. Here's part of their conversation.
One of the things that really stood out to me when I was watching the film was that I felt like it showed examples of healthy masculinity. Mm-hmm. And it felt revelatory, but it also felt accessible. It didn't feel sentimental.
Yeah.
They're vulnerable with each other.
They also have conflict.
Yeah, like people do.
Exactly.
Like anybody does when they're in close quarters together. Yeah.
Yeah, and I feel like that's if anyone who knows how to build anything, especially something artistic together, know that you've got to leave something behind in order to gain something that's more communal.
When you say leave something behind, you mean like ego, like
ego, a way of being that may not be useful for the group, you know, just like bringing in your life experience. You're like, okay, you know, anytime I'm, you know, I do anything in the theater, like, remember, leave that stuff on the outside.
The other thing that I noticed too is the film, it reminded me how masculinity is not necessarily always inherently defined, but enforced. And the way that the men in the film communicated with each other enforced vulnerability as a value and did not enforce that those things made you weak or less than or deserved social punishment.
That, what you just said there, was the light bulb for all of us as we were exploring making this film. These men are saying that this is part of our survival, to have all of these feelings, to have all this softness and tenderness. Mm. And it has nothing to do with sexuality whatsoever. It's more about mental health. It's about being good and kind to yourself and acknowledging your feelings and acknowledging your heartache, acknowledging your trauma, acknowledging what you feel. You know what I mean? Mm. Which feels like a new idea for Black and brown men, or people who witness Black and brown men. And also, the thing that I love the most is that they're holding each other accountable to actually do it.
Yes.
To be in process.
Yes.
To say, it's okay to feel that stuff. For you to be your brother's keeper in a way and say, no, it's okay. Go there.
Absolutely.
We got you, brother. You know?
Yeah, no. And everybody works as a group to call people in or reach out when somebody seems like they're really struggling with something. It's like intuitive. I would say it's intuitive, but it's a practice.
Yeah.
The other thing that I came away from the film with was how prison robs people of the time and opportunity to find and enjoy things that they love. So much of the film was watching so many of these men bloom as artists, like before your eyes. It made me think about the loss to the arts, really to humanity, by not everybody getting the same kind of time and opportunity to actually enjoy participating and creating, right?
The film is not trying to, in any way, shape, or form, we're not being political, we're not calling out anything about the prison industrial complex, but what do we want our society to look like? What tools do we want to give folks? I remember when I first started out, I was touring around to junior high schools and high schools performing. And I would note that arts programs were severely cut. And the first things to go, art. I thought, well, why is that? Well, I grew up with arts programs. Why is that? I'm like, you cut off the art, you cut off the soul, you cut off people understanding how to be human with each other. You cut that out of schools. I feel like there's a path to the prison industrial complex. Art is not frivolous. Art connects us, and we need it in our society. We need it in our schools. You know, a lot of these men who went through this program, they say, you know what, if I had something like this growing up, I probably would never have been here. I would have another way to get out what was inside of me.
I love that reflection. That's wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Coleman. We really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, Brittany.
That was NPR's Brittany Luce speaking with Coleman Domingo. His film Sing Sing is now streaming in prisons across the country. And you can hear more of their conversation on NPR's It's Been a Minute podcast.
This is NPR News. I'm not afraid to
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Sunday's ceasefire between Israel and Hamas is prompting reflection among Jews in the U.S. Dina Prichep reports from Portland, Oregon, where rabbis and activists are weighing the war's many costs.
When the ceasefire was announced, Rabbi Benjamin Barnett felt relief and rage and heartbreak. And like every Saturday for over a year, he recited a prayer. It's an old prayer for the release of captives, adapted to this moment.
Exercise compassion upon them, sparing them from further harm and returning them safe and whole to their families and communities.
Barnett's congregation, Havara Shalom, includes Zionists and anti-Zionists. Barnett says these past 15 months have really stretched them, and they've stretched the traditional prayer, adding lines for the safety of the people of Gaza.
And may all the people of Israel and all the people of Palestine be protected under the wings of your endlessly loving presence. May all inhabitants of the land between the river and the sea know safety, freedom, and dignity.
In Portland's downtown waterfront, another group has also been gathering for a weekly ritual, holding up pictures of Israeli hostages to the people walking by. Organizer Noga Vilan makes a point of saying that holding up pictures of Israelis doesn't mean that they care less about Palestinians. But Vilan is from Israel, and for her, it's personal.
One of the girls, her name is Abigail, her dad went to school with me. He was murdered.
With the hostage deal, Vilan feels some tentative hope, but also grief.
It is very sad that it's the same deal that was on the table back in May of last year. So it's just awful to think of all those lives that we lost, and seriously, 8 months that those people could have been home and the many Palestinian lives that could have been saved.
And she worries that there'll be another October 7th, a few months or years down the road.
That's the biggest fear, I guess, that this war is not really ending, that we are not breaking this hate cycle, we're just doing a ceasefire.
It's not as though part of the terms of this agreement is Hamas saying, oh, we now recognize Israel as a wonderful neighbor and we just want to live in peace and security in our own little space.
Nathan Diamond directs public policy for the Orthodox Union. Unlike the other major denominations, their statement on the ceasefire says, quote, there should still be hell to pay, and it does not mention the war's impact on the people of Gaza. Rabbi Jacob Blumenthal heads the organization representing conservative congregations, which put out a very different statement. But he says while Judaism believes all life is sacred, there's been so much trauma.
The question is, where's our emotional capacity to empathize with the other when you're feeling your own pain? So I don't have any judgment for people who are along that spectrum.
That's the question of this time, says Rabbi Rick Jacobs, who heads the Union for Reform Judaism.
There are chambers of your heart. It's not one chamber. And our tradition commands us to not only care about our own family, and the hostages from Israel are our family, but it also commands us to care for the rest of God's family.
Jacobs acknowledges that this commandment has been a hard one over these past 15 months. In Portland, Oregon, Rabbi Benjamin Barnett has felt that difficulty. His congregation has lost members over it on both sides of the aisle. But he says faith and practice can create a space for that.
One of the things that ritual does is it links us both with each other in this moment. It links us with our ancestors. And I think it reminds us who we really want to be.
Barnett says even in moments of deep hurt and celebration and uncertainty, all of which people are feeling right now, it can be clarifying to connect with something larger, connect with your heart.
It can't just be about what we're resisting. I think it has to be about what is the kind of life that we want to be living? What do we want to be cultivating here? What do we want to be passing down to our children?
In Portland, both Benjamin Barnett and Noga Vilan plan to keep up their weekly practice of offering prayer and holding signs. And both are looking forward to the day when there's no more need. For NPR News, I'm Dina Prichep in Portland, Oregon.
Survivors of the fires in California may have mental health concerns for months to come. Exposure to wildfires is correlated with an increase in conditions like depression and anxiety. And in Los Angeles, hundreds of mental health care workers are on strike. NPR's Katia Riddle reports.
When she heard about the fires, Adriana Webb thought immediately of work.
A lot of my patients live in that area, and I'm very worried about them.
She works for Kaiser Permanente. That's the biggest provider of healthcare in the state. Webb is an infectious disease social worker. Many of the people she works with are living with HIV. She feels certain some of them had to evacuate.
I worry about who's going to be helping them process through that, and also the mental and psychological needs that come from having your safety and security ripped away from you.
Ideally, it would be her helping them, but she hasn't spoken with them in months. She's on strike. She and a colleague are on this day volunteering at a recovery center in downtown Los Angeles. Cassandra Gutierrez-Thompson is a psychiatric social worker with Kaiser Permanente as well. She's standing in a warehouse organizing donations.
So it's been pretty amazing to just see a constant input of local restaurants and, you know, different organizations bringing everything they can from food. Like, we just saw masks, we had water this morning.
Both of these therapists say they are glad to be involved in the relief effort, but this is not ideal. They miss their patients. Here's Adriana Webb again.
Yeah, it's awful. I feel so terrible. But I also know that by being complicit in this system, nothing's ever going to change.
One change this group is seeking from Kaiser Permanente is scheduling. More time for their patients and more time in between patients.
Kaiser treats their therapists like factory workers. Like, we see patients back to back to back without breaks in our day, with no time to treatment plan, no time to coordinate.
There are about 2,500 mental health workers in their union. More than half are on strike. These therapists say they are so pressed for time, they can't go to the bathroom.
I had a colleague who had to get a doctor's note because she's pregnant and she wasn't being able to get bathroom breaks, and she still had issues. We're not getting water breaks.
Rhonda Chabran is vice president of behavioral health for Kaiser Permanente in Southern California. She says that these therapists are provided with breaks in between appointments.
10 minutes between each session is industry standard, and that really is the way that we expect our therapists to practice.
Chabran says Kaiser Permanente is negotiating with the union on this point, however. She also says the organization will be able to meet increased mental health needs in the wake of the fire because they staffed up, anticipating the strike.
We took it upon ourselves to really plan for this and make sure we could cover all of our members with timely appointments, no matter what the occurrence was.
Scheduling is not the only issue. The union is pushing for other things like an increase in pay and benefits. That would bring them in line with other kinds of caregivers. The issue of parity for mental health workers is something that California Senator Scott Wiener has tried to address through legislation.
Mental health and physical health are the same and should be treated the same. We need to stop pretending that mental health treatment is somehow optional. It's not optional.
He says enforcement, both across the country and the state, has just not kept up with mental health parity legislation. The fires have exposed this need.
Now it's time to make sure that those laws are being fully implemented and enforced. And that's what the strike against Kaiser is about. It's about ensuring full compliance with the law.
The wildfires violently destroyed parts of Los Angeles. Now, Senator Wiener says it's within human control to limit their ongoing emotional damage. Katia Riddle, NPR News, Los Angeles.
This is NPR News.
How does one of the 1,500 people convicted in the attack on the U.S. Capitol view his release from prison?
And as far as vindication goes, I've never looked for vindication or anything like that. This is just relief.
So would he do the same thing all over again? After the pardons, on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Thank you.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. You've likely heard of World Wrestling Entertainment, but what about Puppet Wrestling Entertainment?
Weighing in at a combined weight of 3 pounds, Dr. King!
We'll bring you all the action after the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. A six-week-long ceasefire between Hamas and Israel is mostly holding in the Gaza Strip since it began earlier this week. The agreement has paused more than 15 months of war and intense Israeli airstrikes, as NPR's Ea Boutrawi has more on conditions there.
The UN humanitarian relief agency known as OCHA says more food entered Gaza in the first 3 days of the ceasefire than the entire month of October. The surge in aid comes after people in Gaza struggled to find food throughout most of the war. Thousands of children are suffering from acute malnutrition. The latest UN figures also show that 35,000 children are estimated to have had one or both parents killed in Gaza over the past year of war, and a further 17,000 children are unaccompanied after being separated from their families due to hostilities. Additionally, the UN says at least 20% of people in Gaza now have permanent disabilities, with thousands of children having lost one or both legs in the bombardment. Ea Boutrawi, NPR News.
Purdue Pharma and its owners have agreed to increase their financial contribution by billions to settle a massive opioid lawsuit. New York State Attorney General Leticia James says she got help from AGs across the country to secure the deal.
The Sackler family and their company Purdue, who helped spark the opioid crisis decades ago, have for years avoided accountability for the immense cause that they have caused. All of the victims, all of the loved ones who have died, all of those who are in the throes of addiction right now.
The announcement comes after an earlier settlement was rejected last year by the U.S. Supreme Court, saying it improperly protected the once prominent family whose company created and marketed the powerful painkiller OxyContin. The money will go directly to states. This is NPR. The Oscar nominations are making headlines around the world, but have resonated stronger than ever in Brazil. For the first time, a Brazilian film was nominated for 3 Oscars, as Julia Carneiro reports from Rio.
That was the reaction in a leading newsroom in Rio to the Oscar nominations, echoing cheers across the country. The film I'm Still Here received nominations for Best Picture, Best Leading Actress, and Best International Feature Film. Fernanda Torres is the second Brazilian ever nominated for Best Actress. The first was her mother, Fernanda Montenegro, 25 years ago. Torres' performance earned her the Golden Globe for Best Actress in Drama, and Brazilians are now rooting for an Oscar. Directed by Walter Salles, I'm Still Here is based on the true story of a family shaken by a disappearance during Brazil's military dictatorship. For NPR News, I'm Julia Carneiro in Rio de Janeiro.
Jobless claims rose to their highest level in more than 3 years last week. The Labor Department says more than 6,000 people filed claims for unemployment benefits, the most since November of 2021. Although layoffs remain at historic lows, several high-profile companies, including Boeing, GM, and Stellantis, have announced job cuts in the past few months. Well, stocks finished higher on Wall Street today. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil, a fiber supplement containing psyllium, a plant-based fiber for trapping and removing waste in the digestive system, designed to be taken every day. More at Metamucil.com. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. If this morning's Oscar nominations are any indication, Oscar voters are keen on movies with sweeping social themes this year. Netflix's musical about a trans drug lord, Emilia Perez, got 13 nods this morning in another musical, Wicked, and the drama The Brutalist followed close behind.
Tell me, why is an accomplished foreign architect shoveling coal here in Philadelphia?
I'm afraid it is not so simple.
NPR film critic Bob Mondello has seen them all and is here to talk through the nominations with us. Hey there.
Hi, good to be here.
Good to have you. So, Bob, let's just start by talking through the Best Picture nods. We mentioned three of them, Emilia Perez, Wicked, and The Brutalist. Can you start off by telling us about those movies?
Well, sure. You're absolutely right about them being a socially conscious bunch. Emilia Perez is centrally about trans identity. The Brutalist is about immigrant trauma and anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. Wicked is a cheery little musical that just all the subtext is about resisting prejudice and authoritarianism and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I understand that A Complete Unknown also got nominated. And if I remember correctly, that is the Bob Dylan biopic?
Yes, and that sounds like a sort of an outlier because it's just a biopic, right? Except that he was a big deal in the social protest movements in the 1960s. So that goes in there, too. There's also The Substance with Demi Moore. It's sort of a body horror flick that's all about unrealistic expectations that society has about female form and aging. Conclave, the Vatican thriller, is about selecting a pope, but it has a subplot about identity right. politics. Anora plays a sort of sexy comic romp, but it's a Cinderella story about a sex worker and a rich Russian kid who's trying to get citizenship.
Will you marry me?
Seriously?
Seriously.
3 carrots.
What about 4?
All right, let me throw in one here, and I want to throw this in because this is a film I actually saw recently. It's I'm Still Here. It's a Brazilian film. It's about family life and memory under political oppression.
Yes, absolutely. And it fits nicely with Nickel Boys, which is about racism in the Jim Crow South, and Dune Part 2 even, which is, it's a sci-fi
right.
flick, but it's also about colonialism. It's arguably about religious fanaticism. These are serious pictures.
All right. I want to bring it back, if we can, to Emilia Perez. The star actress Carla Sofia Gascon is the first openly trans person to be nominated mm-hmm. for acting, and her co-star Zoe Saldana was nominated as supporting actress. Bob, did you see this coming?
Everybody saw it coming in a way because it's sort of an Oscar nomination machine. It's got 2 star parts. It's an international film, so there's the possibility of that. It has 2 original songs. If you throw in screenplay, director, and picture, it's halfway there before you even get started. The other films don't have that.
Got it. Okay, so we've got the nominations. We've run through all of those, but you are our expert. So I want to ask you, what do you think it is that Oscar voters miss this time around?
Whenever somebody asked me what to see, my first reaction is The Brutalist. My second is always A Real Pain.
You used to cry about everything.
Yeah, it was awful. Who wants to cry about everything?
We're in a Holocaust tour.
If now is not the time to grieve, I don't want to tell you.
I wish that had gotten nominated for Best Picture. The Substance did get nominated for Best Picture. I wish it had gotten more subsidiary awards. And then Challengers was an amazing, sexy, fun movie. It came out in April. It's got great music, and it's like it got left out. It's just not there. I think it came out too soon.
That's NPR movie critic Bob Mondello. Thanks so much.
It's always a pleasure.
Now an update on how certain military weapons may injure the brains of people who fire them. NPR's John Hamilton reports on research suggesting that the blast waves from shoulder-fired anti-tank weapons can damage blood vessels in the brain.
A blow to the head tends to injure brain structures near the surface, but a blast wave keeps going. Dr. Ebolia Chernak of Belmont University in Nashville says it interacts with the entire body, causing blood to surge into the brain like a tsunami.
In blast, because of that tsunami inside our body through the blood vessels, the structures are much deeper. So we are talking about brainstem, we are talking about cerebellum. So all of the very nicely cushioned inside brain structures.
A big explosion, like a bomb, can cause catastrophic bleeding in the brain. But repeated exposure to what the military calls low-level blasts, including those from rocket and missile launchers, seems to cause more subtle changes to the brain's blood supply. Chernek says this can affect deep structures like the brainstem, which controls breathing, heart rate, and blood pressure.
Could be that a veteran comes because of uncontrolled blood pressure, which is resistant toward antihypertensive treatment, because the problem is in that main control in the brainstem.
One especially vulnerable structure is the blood-brain barrier, a layer of cells lining the inner surface of blood vessels. These cells form a membrane that usually keeps toxins out of the brain while allowing oxygen and nutrients to get in. Chernek says animal studies show that exposure to repeated blast waves impairs this system.
It does change the functionality of the blood-brain barrier, meaning the blood-brain barrier starts to be leaky.
That leaky barrier makes the brain more susceptible to infections and less able to remove waste products. The damage also leads to inflammation, which can disrupt connections in the brain. And Chernek says it reduces the flow of oxygen and nutrients to neurons, the cells that allow movement and thinking.
The neurons are now starving. They don't have enough energy. So we are ending up with neural cell death.
The military's interest in low-level blast exposure began about a decade ago. Scientists were studying military breachers who use explosives to remove obstacles or gain access to a secured building. The study involved participants in a 2-week breacher training program. Stephen Ollers of the Naval Medical Research Command says tests found no impact on students.
But we had 5 instructors that we just sort of decided to throw into the study, and they were the ones that showed some psychological effects,
including memory problems. The result led to a series of studies on low-level blast in both animals and military personnel. Early results found evidence of harm to neurons. More recent studies have shown that blood vessels are also damaged or altered. Ollers says it's not yet clear how much blast force or overpressure is safe.
We have tended to focus on the biggest weapon systems, the shoulder-fired weapons, where they're very close to your head, and the ones that have the most overpressure profiles. We're not quite sure what the thresholds are.
Ollers says it is clear that at some point, overpressure begins to affect what's known as the neurovascular unit, a complex system that makes sure brain cells are getting enough blood. One of Ollers' own studies looked at a protective layer of proteins in blood vessels.
After exposure to a blast overpressure, it's basically stripped off. It takes about a month for it to sort of grow back.
Other changes may be permanent. For example, repeated blast exposure impairs these smooth muscle cells that allow blood vessels to regulate pressure and flow.
You may not be able to tell the differences in blood flow just under normal conditions, but when you stimulate, you see that the smooth muscles have changed how they contract.
They contract with less force. And Ollers says at least one study in animals found that blast exposure might also cause an arteriovenous malformation, an abnormal tangle of veins and arteries that can cause fatal bleeding. John Hamilton, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Every week, a famous guest draws a card from the wild card deck and answers a big question about their life. At age 77, Ted Danson seems just as productive now as he was in his days on Cheers. He currently stars in the Netflix show A Man on the Inside, and he hosts a hit podcast called Where Everybody Knows Your Name. He reflected on aging with wild card host Rachel Martin.
How often do you think about death?
Ooh, a lot. I flip my brain. I've trained it and I like it. And it may not be real, but my brain immediately tries to contextualize and spin myself away from fear. I don't like living in fear. And I have tons of it. You know, it comes up. I had so much fun doing a classic spy that halfway through it, I was going, oh. Oh, don't die. let me finish
to yourself.
This.
That's what you were saying.
Yeah. But and then I go, wait a minute. What you're really saying is, you are so happy to be doing what you're doing. Don't take it away from me, life. You know, so instead of being fearful, just say, oh my God, thank you, thank you, thank you for this blessing that I have. Because then I can live in gratitude, which is more joyful, and I don't have to live in fear.
So I have a, I guess I have another question related to this, because you did, you have talked publicly about suffering from plaque psoriasis for a long time. And right. I wonder if that experience made you think differently about your body and your own kind of physical fragility.
Oh, definitely. And I could never look at myself in the mirror. I was born without a chest muscle. I was 6 foot at 13 and weighed 120 pounds. And then when I was 25, I got psoriasis. I was never able to go, you know, oh, what a glorious creature you are in your Speedo. So I think self-deprecating humor came out of that. My mother also was dealt wonderfully with the light things of life. When things were dark, which life has, she had trouble with that. So there were things like, phrases like pride goeth before a fall, you know, that kind of stuck in my head. And it was, so it's like being prideful, even though I am, it was something that I tried not to be because I didn't want the fall. Even having a conversation with you today where I'm kind of forcing it to be on the higher level of the joy meter. Because that's what I like to.
That's where you like to live, yeah.
Hear back,
I get it.
You know, but I am also very aware that I will step out of here and directly into a pile of karmic poo, because that's just the way life works. Mr. Ted, who thinks he's so wonderful dancing, you know, will get a reflection of the truth. But that's fun. That's funny.
You can hear more of that conversation with Ted Danson on the Wildcard Podcast.
Support for Wildcard with Rachel Martin comes from the NPR Wine Club, bringing people wines inspired by NPR shows. Whether purchasing a few bottles or joining the club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. It's been more than a month since rebel forces drove Syria's regime from power. But in a threat to the country's fragile stability, fighting between rival factions continues in parts of the country. The fiercest fighting is taking place in Syria's north, where both the U.S. and Turkey are involved. NPR's Jaina Raff traveled close to the front line and brings us this story.
We're standing on a country road along the Euphrates River in the north of Syria. Turkish tanks travel a nearby highway, but this road is along the riverside, with tall, skinny trees leading down to mist rising over deep blue water. A militia commander stops. He calls us over. Less than 20 miles from the border with Turkey, he assumes we're Turkish, and he tells us in broken Arabic it's dangerous up ahead. And just a mile away is a bridge that is now the front line. Enemies at the bridge, he tells us. Drones, terrorist militias, landmines. The commander, who goes by his battle name, Abu Suleiman, is from an Arab-Turkish-backed group. The terrorists he's referring to is a Turkish-Kurdish faction that has been fighting Turkey for decades. Those fighters are entwined with a main U.S. ally, the Syrian Kurdish forces. Fighters gather around us as we talk. The U.S. has mediated a truce between the factions. But here, near a strategic dam, it's not holding. While Abu Suleiman says he appreciates the U.S. role, it's Turkey safeguarding their interests. America is a friend, but Turkey is a brother, he says. A fighter from another Turkish-backed militia tells us to move off the road into the shelter of the trees. He's worried about attack drones. He asks for security reasons to be identified only by his first name, Hassan. Now, if they surrender their weapons and come under the control of the state, we welcome them, he says of the Kurdish forces. He agrees with Syria's transitional government that all factions need to come under central command. That's it, one leader, one army, one state. But if the situation is like this and everyone wants to take over an area, it won't work, he says. It isn't just the countryside where things are tense. 20 miles west of the Euphrates, the city of Manbij is under new control. It was part of the Kurdish region until Turkish-backed forces drove out the Kurds in December. Everywhere is the sound of motorcycles, many of them ridden by armed fighters with headscarves and long flowing hair popular with Islamist militias. Most civilians don't want to talk. Go find someone else, one man says. But privately, we hear that no one is sure who these fighters are, that people don't go out at night because they're afraid. In one shop, a computer technician, Izzedine Mustafa, says people are waiting for the new Syrian government to bring order.
Do people think it's safe now?
I think not too much, because as you know, we don't have like a government or anything organized. So we need a time, I think.
He says everyone wants peace, but with so many countries and factions involved, he says no one feels it's within their control. Jaina Raff, NPR News, Manbij, Syria.
World Wrestling Entertainment has some competition. Well, sort of. Puppet Wrestling Entertainment is making the rounds. You won't see The Rock or Hulk Hogan fly across the ring or hit the mat. This show's star is a puppet called Dr. Kiss, and he wants the championship belt no matter the cost. Reporter Buffy Gorilla has the details.
I'm here in a rehearsal barn where the show is about to begin.
Coming down the aisle, weighing in at a combined weight of 3 pounds, please welcome Dr. Kiss!
The lights go up. Three puppeteers in Lucha Libre wrestling masks hold a wooden puppet that is about 2 feet tall, with arms and legs made of wood and plastic. that can bend in all directions.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another exciting evening of puppet wrestling entertainment. Hello,
the puppeteers stand behind a miniature three-sided wrestling ring with the words Puppet Mania splashed across the front.
My, do we have an exciting card lined up for you tonight as we are on the road to Puppet Mania.
Dr. Kiss is the puppet star of Kayfabe. It's a puppet wrestling entertainment spectacular, says creator Josh Rice. He says Kayfabe is not only the name of the show, but it's a concept crucial to the world of wrestling.
Kayfabe is just like in theater, how we suspend our disbelief. Just like how we watch a movie, just like how we read a good story, we allow ourselves to believe in the fiction of it to sometimes enjoy it more.
For years, kayfabe has long been synonymous with the in-the-ring performances of pro wrestlers.
We know that what they're doing to one another looks really violent. And if it were true and real, they would be bleeding all the time and they could only do maybe one move and then the match would be over. One punch, really, and then the match would be over.
Rice created this world as a playful homage to the sport he watched with his dad as a kid. There's a face, the good guy, and the heel, the bad guy. There's loud music, costumes, props, and over-the-top moves.
Dancing and catchphrases that are a little lame, like, you know, in wrestling they often can be, especially from a certain era.
As Dr. Kiss enters to his own theme music, his hands are clapped in time by head puppeteer Emma Wiseman, working with two others to bring Dr. Kiss to life.
There's also a lot of negotiating other people's bodies. You're so close to your two other sort of puppeteer colleagues.
And learning the best way to move Dr. Kiss takes practice.
Just like in dance, you know, these complex ways of lifting people or flipping people, you're just like putting your hands around his belly and like jumping and like slamming him to the ground.
During the performance, the puppeteers really seem to disappear as Rice calls the play-by-play in a raucous pro wrestling style.
Dr. Kiss now on the top rope, getting ready to deliver his patented finishing maneuver, the Kiss of Death.
The puppeteers maneuver Dr. Kiss to the top rope, and he raises his little hand to his little ear to get the audience going. And in the next moment, he hits the mat.
And now the referee is counting. One, two, three. Dr. Kiss has got to get back to his feet. Four.
Dr. Kiss is taking the show on the road. This weekend, Chicago, and later, Las Vegas. It's wrestling with the same energy, surprise endings, and smaller-than-life characters. It's a real WrestleMania. For NPR News, I'm Buffy Gorilla.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person, with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at Viking.com. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From Workday, with AI at the core of its system, Workday is committed to delivering continuous innovation to prepare organizations for what's next. Workday, an enterprise platform for finance and HR rock stars. And from the John S. and J.